The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Hamas has elected Yahya Sinwar as the new leader of the political wing of Hamas. Thought to be the mastermind behind the October 7th attacks, it's sure to bring issues in future as the people on both sides of the negotiating table would be increasingly hardline. Now, to give us the latest, political analyst with the Clinton Institute, UCD Professor Scott Lucas. Scott, good morning.
Very good morning to you, Pat.
Now, the reason for this, Yahya Sinwar has not been seen. He's thought to be hiding in Gaza, possibly in plain sight. But why did they make this decision?
Well, of course, the reason why they had to make this decision is that 9 days ago, Israel carried out a targeted assassination, killing the then Hamas political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. We initially thought that he would be replaced by another official from the political wing of Hamas, say like Khaled Mashal, who has previously held the post. But in a bit of a surprise, they've turned to the military head, to Yahya Sinwar, who is still in Gaza, and as you know, probably very closely hidden amongst the population to avoid Israel being killed by Israel. The effect of this is that it unites Hamas's political and military wings. Indeed, it effectively puts the military in charge of political affairs and thus in charge of any ceasefire negotiations.
But the man himself is scarcely likely to be able to journey to any negotiating table.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and so, you know, the net effect of killing Haniyeh, who was, you know, based in Qatar, was able to move about, was able to negotiate with the international mediators, was that you could at least talk about the possibility of a ceasefire, even as, to be honest with you, I thought the chances of it were fairly slim, especially given Benjamin Netanyahu's position in Israel. Now that you remove Haniyeh, you know, you're counting on Sinwar being able to communicate with those outside the country in terms of issuing instructions for any talks, because there's no way that those who are in Qatar or in Egypt, where the chatter is the talks will resume next week. No way they're going to take any decisions without clearance from Sinwar.
Now, it's interesting. We know that Netanyahu has been accused of war crimes on foot of what has been going on, but equally Yahya Sinwar has. So the idea that you've got proxies for two war criminals actually negotiating, it seems on the face of it somewhat bizarre.
Well, that's where we are in Gaza, when you have mass killings that have been carried out by both sides. You know, there were mass killings that were overseen by Hamas. And by the way, not just by Sinwar, but the political leadership would have known about this on October 7th. And then Israel has responded with more than 10 months of mass killings being overseen by, of course, you know, its prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and others in the cabinet. You know, and both sides have been willing to kill. Those are war crimes. They're ongoing war crimes. It's just a tragic and sad fact that you cannot reach a ceasefire without those who have blood on their hands giving the approval for any type of end to this.
So all this talk in the last 48 hours about the possibility of renewed ceasefire talks, is this completely meaningless?
It's not completely meaningless in terms of, I think, positioning. I think, for example, it makes sense for the international community, and the call has specifically come out from the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar to resume the talks, not only for the idea that you at least want to keep the process going, even if the chances of success are you know, slim or none, to provide an alternative to killing. And it's also, you know, important signaling because, you know, only a few days ago, we thought we were on the verge of, you know, Israel-Iran confrontation after Israel's killing of Haniyeh. And indeed, that possibility still isn't completely gone. So you sort of want to put it out there as a signal to try to get everybody to take a step back in the region. And I also think, you know, we need to pay close attention in terms of Israel. I think it makes sense for Israel to say that they will go back to the talks because it means that it puts Hamas in the position of either having to say, yes, we will talk, or rejecting the negotiations, which would put them in a bad PR position. But I also think that Netanyahu is willing to end this mass killing once he wipes out the Hamas leadership. Now, he's killed Mohammed Daif, who is the man who organized the October 7th mass killings. He's killed Ismail Haniyeh. If they can kill Yahya Sinwar, then I think Netanyahu may finally say, provided he can get the hostages back from Hamas, okay, we'll stop now. In other words, you keep up the appearance of talking while you continue to try to knock out Sinwar and declare victory.
Now, although Israel has banned Al Jazeera in transmitting its programs within Israel, it doesn't mean that Israel's media are completely subservient to the will of the government. On Tuesday, Israel's Channel 12 News aired surveillance footage that appears to show Israeli soldiers sexually assaulting a Palestinian prisoner in southern Israel. Two things. One, deeply embarrassing were this to be verified. And number two, if it is genuine footage, how did it emerge from within the maw of the IDF?
Well, on the first point, I think it's important to add the context that, you know, human rights organizations have said with evidence that Palestinian detainees have been abused in Israeli prisons for many, many years, long before the current cycle of violence. So with regret, I say that the actual incident is not new. For it to be exposed is new. And I think it does point as to what you indicate, which is not all Israelis support what Benjamin Netanyahu and his inner circle are doing. Not all of them support the mass killings in Gaza, and not all of them support what that leadership is doing with respect to Palestinians, including in the West Bank. So I suspect that amidst a lot of discontent with Netanyahu, including from his own military, about failing to get to an endpoint in this conflict, that there are those from inside the government and those who are inside other Israeli groups who have links to the government who are willing to bring this information out.
And we don't know the motivation, whether it's the high moral ground or whether or not it has, you know, a political motive in its release.
No, we don't. And obviously, whoever leaked it is not going to put their heads above the parapet and say, look, it was us, because they would face retaliation within Israel. I do think, however, Pat, it just points to this idea of that there is a wide variety of views in Israel. I think probably a large majority, not a large majority, majority probably still support the military operations, but some, even amongst those, question how the military operations are being conducted. And I think there's a significant part of Israel's population that wants to see the government get back to a position where it is not committing abuses, where it is not internationally isolated because of those abuses. And dare I say it, there are some in Israel who genuinely want to see a move back to negotiations for a two-state solution.
One of the most, I suppose, gruesome and also disturbing pieces of video we saw in the last few days was the return by Israel of the remains of Palestinians. Where they were retrieved from, I don't know, but they were all mixed up. I mean, bodies could not be distinguished from other bodies, body parts and so on. The Palestinians were shown, you know, trying to assemble bodies, trying to establish who was who, and then digging a mass grave for the bits that they could not account for. I mean, why did the Israelis do that?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question, because, you know, when you describe it in such graphic detail and accurate detail, it points out to the fact that the Israelis have obliterated, you know, just obliterated many civilians, tens of thousands of civilians in the past 10 and a half months. But of course, if you frame it in a different way, and it has been framed as a different way within Israel, it's the idea of that it's the Israelis who are making the compassionate step of at least returning bodies to loved ones who themselves are still under threat in Palestine, specifically in Gaza. So it was sort of a PR step, the way that it's rejigged. But I think you're right. That bit of PR cannot erase, at least for some of us, the fact that just as Hamas obliterated Israelis, and I think we have to
remind ourselves of that all the time,
that they obliterated Israeli civilians on October the 7th and foreign nationals, and that they took them hostage, that Israel then, or at least the Israeli leadership, has used this as the pretext for 10 plus months to carry out these killings. So they'll return those body parts, those scattered body parts, right? And on that day when they return them, you know what? A few more dozen Gazans were killed.
I want to talk about domestic politics in the United States with you as well, Scott, because you obviously keep an eye on things there. And I want to just do contrasting campaign styles at the moment. First of all, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who's the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats, he spoke at a rally in Philadelphia after being introduced by Vice President Kamala Harris as a running mate. Just have a listen to the energy of this speech.
Thank you, Madam Vice President, for the trust you put in me, but maybe more so, thank you for bringing back the joy. I'm thrilled to be on this journey with you and Doug, this incredible journey. And Pennsylvania, I know you know this, but my God, what a treasure you have in Josh Shapiro. Holy hell, can this guy bring the fire? He can bring the fire. This is a visionary leader. Also, I have to tell you, everybody in America knows when you need a bridge fixed, call that guy. And I think sometimes we forget and you see people a little one-dimensional, but seeing a guy who cares so deeply about his family, a man with compassion, vision, and I'll have to tell you this, I know this from experience, there is no one you would rather go to a Springsteen concert in Jersey with than him, than that guy. Roots! And I can't wait for all of you and America to get to know my incredible wife, Gwen, a 29-year public school educator. Don't ever underestimate teachers.
So that's a highly energized Tim Walz, really working the crowd in Philadelphia. Now, Donald Trump called a press conference in Mar-a-Lago yesterday, and it was quite a long affair and quite a rambling affair, but he claimed that the crowd who attended his January the 6th rally was larger than the one that witnessed Martin Luther King's famous speech. He was responding to a question about whether he thought the end of his term could be considered a peaceful transfer of power, even though it was marked by the January 6th insurrection.
If you look at January 6th, which a lot of people aren't talking about very much, I think those people were treated very harshly. When you compare them to other things that took place in this country where a lot of people were killed, nobody was killed on January 6th. But I think that the people of January 6th were treated very unfairly. And they were there to complain, not through me, they were there to complain about an election. And, you know, it's very interesting. The biggest crowd I've ever spoken to, and I said peacefully and patriotically, which nobody wants to say, but I said peacefully and patriotically, the biggest crowd I've ever spoken to, and you've seen, Maggie, I was in at the mall. I was at the Washington Monument. I was at the whole thing. I had crowds. I don't know who's ever had a bigger crowd than I have, but I had it many times. The biggest crowd I've ever spoken before was that day. And I'll tell you, it's very hard to find a picture of that crowd. You see the picture of a small number of people relatively going to the Capitol, but you never see the picture of the crowd. The biggest crowd I've ever spoken, I've spoken to the biggest crowds. Nobody's spoken to crowds bigger than me. If you look at Martin Luther King, when he did his speech, his great speech, and you look at ours, same real estate, same everything, same number of people, if not, we had more. And they said he had 1 million people, but I had 25,000 people. But when you look at the exact same picture, and everything's the same because it was the fountains, the whole thing, all the way back to from Lincoln to Washington, and you look at it, and you look at the picture of his crowd, my crowd, we actually had more people. They said I had 25,000, and he had 1 million people. And I'm okay with it because I liked Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, Scott, compare and contrast.
In 2016, Pat, Michelle Obama, who some of your listeners may know about, said, when they go low, we go high. You know, that was a pretty inspirational thing in New Hampshire, inspirational line in New Hampshire. But Donald Trump won that year, still won the Electoral College. Here we are 8 years later. and you just had high versus low. If you go with Governor Tim Walz, who a lot of people wouldn't have heard of before the past week, he now, as the vice presidential pick, is contributing to the surge of the Harris campaign. And if we took apart what he said, public service, tick. His wife's public service, tick. Responsibility in office, tick. Family, tick. Comparing that implicitly with Trump's approach to family and approach to women and children, tick. A reference to Bruce Springsteen, who's an icon in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey area, tick. By the way, they weren't booing him when he said that. They were saying Bruce. And specifically praising Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who was also in the running to become vice president, tick. Right? That hits all the notes to unify the Democrats and to unify bringing the joy into politics, the country. Go to Trump. And what do we have there? Fact check. About 10,000 people, when he addressed those people at the White House and told them to stop the peaceful transfer of power on January 6, 2021. Martin Luther King's address march in 1963, the March on Washington, at least 250,000 people. Lie. Tick. But think about how he then spun that lie. He wasn't talking about the country. He wasn't talking about responsibility, public service. He was talking about his ego. It was the largest crowd for anybody. I am the most important here. And I think it frames this campaign of, and it's a toss-up election. Do people go for that message of public service and responsibility in rebuilding America? Or do they go because they're loyal followers of one man who is above all of that?
The word weird, initially introduced into the campaigning by Tim Walz, it appears to be more on the money now than ever before. I mean, Trump did appear to be certain. Well, he is the oldest candidate in the race, but he suddenly seemed to have aged.
Trump has had cognitive issues for years, Pat. I mean, when he talks to people about that he took a cognitive ability test when he was president, that wasn't to show how smart he was. That was because there were doubts about that ability, reportedly, in some quarters after he suffered a mini stroke. And we do know that he gets facts wrong even when he doesn't lie. But I think there's a broader point here, and that is that type of invective that he's using, which is now a rambling invective, means that there's no address of issues, that there's no address of what might concern people on a day-to-day basis. And then to add to the weirdness, his much younger vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, is literally stalking Harris and Walz by going to the same states they're going to this week. And at one moment this week, decided, despite all security, he would start to go towards Air Force Two, which is the plane that Harris and Walz were using, just to check it out before the security people said, look, you can't do that. And he said, oh, I'm just going to look at this plane because I'm anticipating what it's going to be like when I'm vice president. That's a level of weirdness. But I think at the end of the day, this goes beyond weirdness. It goes down to a question of decency and tolerance. And which of these campaigns is going to show that in the next 3 months?
Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin. Scott, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.